Columbia in the summer of 1944. The university was a relatively small institution and the youngest institution in Canada. The total full-time winter student enrollment had been about 2,300. It had a summer school for teachers and odds and ends like that.
Yes.
Because of the war, practically every male who was physically fit enrolled in this one or other of the three service training units, the COTC, the UNTD, or the RUS, the Air Force.
Yes.
They had their separate uniforms, their separate commanding officers, and so on. Mm-hmm. But the COTC was much the largest. Dr. Gordon Shrum, who was professor of physics and head of the Department of Physics, was also colonel of the COTC. He was a man of great energy and imagination. And he had prevailed or persuaded the members of the COTC to waive the pay that was due them. And with that, he proceeded with support and encouragement from the university authorities to build the armories. And the armories had in them, on this mezzanine floor, a very attractive officers' mess, and to where they served meals and had meetings of the officers, a very comfortable and adequate lounge and kitchen facility and dining room, and to furnish the lounge and make it look more attractive, Gordon Shrum bought, for a very modest price, I don't imagine more than $100, two or three Emily cars that now would probably be worth $15,000-$20,000. Mm-hmm. The way her portrait paintings have gone up.
Yes.
Anyway, in any event, the COTC, I think, had a maximum enrollment during that period of something of the order of 1,200 members. And as they were needed for service overseas in the various units, they moved out and into those units, and the younger ones, freshmen coming in, joined the COTC or the other units, the Navy or the Air Force. Professor McElraith in engineering was head of the UNTD, and I had his name on my tongue.
Mr. Harris?
Harris. Alan Harris in chemistry was head of the RUS.
I'd like to ask you, you must have seen COTC facilities on campuses, other campuses, and how would you compare the UBC?
The UBC were far and away the best in any university in Canada, thanks very largely to Gordon Shrum and what I described as the energy and imagination that he had. It also seemed to have stimulated interest in the student body generally, and they participated very effectively, as witness their willingness to allow the waived pay to accumulate and to be used to build the armories.
Mm-hmm.
To build it much more economically then than at any time since. We also had areas available for drill purposes, and they went off to summer camps. where the Department of National Defense had arranged for them to do their summer training. And I remember the first spring I was here, which was the spring of 1945, I had come in the summer of it. They were in Chilliwack, and I went up one weekend to spend with them and see the work they were doing and all of that. And Sunday morning after church parade, three or four of the young men went out in a canoe on Cultus Lake. And for some, it was a fine, bright, sunny morning and not particularly windy. For some unexplained reason, they upset, and though they were good swimmers, they had been at the camp up at Elphinstone, the YMCA, and that. They were drowned. This naturally was a shock and a very saddening experience to all of us, all of the members of the COTC and to the university generally, and particularly to the parents and friends of those boys. Apparently the water was so cold that when they fell in it, they weren't too far from shore, but the shock was such that they just drowned. Mm-hmm. But the women, they also engaged in appropriate activities, usually with first aid and Red Cross training and experience. They also had, I think, Dean Gage, Professor Gage, as he was then in mathematics, under his supervision and direction, organized the training of radar technicians for the three services, and again accumulated a substantial amount of money, which later formed part of the money that was used to build the President's house on Point Grey. Incidentally, the President's house on Point Grey didn't cost the taxpayers of British Columbia or the government of British Columbia any money. The work was done by the university crews, carpenters, electricians, plumbers, and cabinet makers. And they did such a fine job and were so proud of it that the first reception Ms. McKenzie and I had in that home when we went into it at Christmas 50, New Year's 51, was to invite all the workmen and their wives to come and inspect the house and see what their husbands had been doing and so on and so forth. But this is how that was until then a part of the fortress area on Point Grey.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was university property, but the government had expanded their area, which you might call their own legitimate area, to include all of the area where the President's house is and beyond. And they returned it to us, that part of it, so that we could build on it. The Northwest Telephone Company, also the wireless one, had their pole erected in that area, right in front of where the President's house now is. And we had not difficulty, but it took time to arrange for them to move them from where they were a little farther south and west, still on the university property, but not evident from the house itself. But coming back to the COTC, as I say, they were probably at the peak of their careers during and immediately following World War I. Gordon Shrum.
World War II, you mean?
World War II. Gordon Shrum carried on as officer commanding, despite taking on the job of chairman of the housing committee as well. in which he had a great deal to do with having the huts moved on. I made the arrangements. I happened to know most of the appropriate ministers in Ottawa. They were friends of mine, like Colonel Walston, who was Minister of National Defense and also Minister of Finance. I had served as a private with him, or a non-commissioned officer, or what you will, in World War I. And Brooke Claxton, who became Minister of National Defense, and Doug Abbott, who became Minister of Finance, Ilsley, who was Minister of Finance, so on. All of these were personal friends of mine. I could get them on the long-distance phone and say, there are such and such huts that are not presently being used by the military, and the red tape will take far too long to make them available for our purposes. We propose to move them immediately, and we'll take care of the necessary formalities later on. And in this way, we were able to acquire immediately a number of the huts that were Abbott's Ford, and actually in the endowment lands and over in North Vancouver. We also acquired the use of the military establishments at Little Mountain and out at Sea Island as housing for the veterans. And one of the main operations was taking over the Air Force base at Euculet and Tofino on the west side of Vancouver Island. Those huts had to be knocked down, loaded on scows, towed all the way around Vancouver Harbor, unloaded, trucked out onto the campus, and reconstructed. And we acquired at that time, I think it was 110 huts, and a hangar, and about 12 or 14 of what we call dog houses. They were little, maybe 12 by 12 buildings. I don't know exactly what they were used for. Over at the base there, but Dr. Shrum asked me whether I thought we should bother bringing them over, and I said, well, we'll bring everything, bring them too. And they proved to be among the most popular of the residence accommodation that we provided for the veterans, including the married veterans, because we were able to rent them to them for $5 a month. And we provided, in another adjacent hut, laundry facilities, baths, showers, toilet facilities, and all of that kind of thing.
You told me earlier that you lived in one of these.
We lived in a hut in Acadia Camp, in what came to be known as President's Row, because we lived in it. And that particular hut was brought down from Abbotsford, I think. And Ms. Mackenzie and I and our three young children enjoyed it very much. It was one of the smartest things that I did, but quite unconsciously and without intention, because it made both students and faculty feel that the president was really one of them. We saw them in very intimate conditions, circumstances, and we lived exactly the kind of life, put up with the same kind of limitations and restrictions, and enjoyed the intimacy of their friendship in a way that would have been quite impossible had we lived in Shaughnessy or Southwest Marine Drive or somewhere else. So, as I say, it was most enjoyable.
After World War II, in contrast to World War I, there seemed to have made, there was still a lot of interest in military training?
There was, for a period, continued pretty well until the Department of National Defense decided that the officer training units were not worth the money that they were spending on them. Personally, I think this was a very short-sighted, mistaken view. I think that the officer training units contributed more to the effective purposes of the Department of National Defense for infinitely less money than any other work or unit or department under their care and charge. But as I say, they were looking for economies, and they slashed them off, as they did a lot of the militia units too.
Yes.
I think this was very short-sighted and mistaken, but somebody, whether it was the brass or the minister or the government, I don't know, probably a mixture of them all, was what they did.
Yeah, I would like to come to this a little later. I wonder if we could, like, go back to stay with all the immediate post-war period and your involvement. For example, you had been on the Joint Services Committee.
Yes, I was on that for until it was wound up pretty well. And we had the administration of the funds, and there were a fair amount of money in the funds of the three units that had accumulated from the wage pay and over and above the cost of the building of the armories and that, because the waiving the pay continued afterward. I'm not sure what other functions the Joint Services Committee had. We always had a Joint Service Ball in the wintertime down at Sea Island, not Sea Island, Edmund Island, isn't it, where the naval buildings are.
On Discovery, are you referring to?
Is that Discovery Island? It's in
not Discovery Island.
Cole Harbor.
Yes.
Well, that's Edmund.
I know the name, but I can't remember the name.
Anyway, the ball was usually held in the
Deadman's Island,
the drill hall of the Navy unit there, and attended by the Lieutenant Governor and his lady and all the officers and all the various units, militia units and the permanent force and so on. A gala occasion in which the young men of the three services brought their best girls or their wives, as the cases may be. The Joint Services Committee helped in arranging these and organizing them and that. The actual training, of course, was in the hands of the Department of National Defense and the officers of the units themselves. And the Department of National Defense attached to the units permanent force officers, whom we grew to know and liked very much. After some time with us, they would go back to other postings in other parts of the country.
What role did you have in the succession of commanding officers?
Well, I came time for Dr. Shrum, who had been in that position for many years, relatively many, during the war and following the war, to give up command. And normally, one of the staff members, by that I mean the professors, who were also serving as officers of the COTC, would have succeeded and certainly expected to succeed. But I didn't think that any of them had the kind of qualifications or temperaments that lent themselves to good commanding officers of the COTC. It so happened that Bob Bonner was a had been a student, served with distinction with the Sea Force in Italy and later on in the northeastern Europe, I believe, was wounded and had come home as a casualty and had taken up again the study of law. And he struck me as being the kind of person with war experience, actual military training and experience, who would make a first-rate commanding officer. So I requested the Department of National Defense that they should appoint Bob Bonner as the officer commanding the COTC to succeed Dr. Schramm. First, they refused to go along with this because this was contrary to their policy. They had never had a student as the officer commanding a COTC unit anywhere in the country. But I explained the circumstances to them, and as I say, having some influence with the people in Ottawa, they finally agreed, and Bob Bonner took over. Dr. Schramm remained as the honorary lieutenant colonel, and they were good enough, the unit and Ottawa, to appoint me as the honorary colonel. So Schramm and I would appear on the parades, the passing out parades, and on other occasions I sometimes turned up in my uniform of the 85th Nova Scotia Highlanders, wearing the kilt and other accoutrements of that regiment. Other times I would wear the regular blues of an officer in the militia of Canada. I usually insisted on wearing my own collar badges and cap badges from my old regiment, despite military regulations to the contrary. And as I say, we took part in them, but Bob Bonner carried on until he went into politics and became the Attorney General under Mr. Bennett. And Finley Morrison, I think it was, took on from him.
Yeah. First it was John McLean.
John McLean.
Yes.
John, too, had been with the Sea Force, severely wounded. He was on campus as director of personnel and relations with the employed staff. He was a very fine human being and a very good officer. And John McLean became the officer commanding the COTC and served the usual term, whatever it is, I've forgotten, several years. And he was succeeded, of course, by Finley Morrison. And he was succeeded by Dr. Lawrence Ranta. Ranta was the medical officer, and I think he was also the officer in charge of the mess in the armories.
Yes, he was.
And had some hand in the furnishings and decorations and organization of the mess. But all of these made excellent commanding officers. They're efficient and popular with the student body. They turned out, of course, on Armistice
yes.
Day for the armistice service that was always held by the university in the War Memorial Gymnasium after it was built. And here again, the officer training units on campus lent their support and their help in raising the money for that building. They also provided the Guards of Honor on other occasions and provided the units for ceremonials, university ceremonials. We had, soon after the war, a full and first-rate pipe band. Frank Ross, who later became Lieutenant Governor and who was very interested in his Scottish traditions and background, was glad to assist in financial ways in the purchase of the pipes, the drums, and the uniforms of the pipers. And a number of us had in mind that we would have them decked out in the Seaforth tartan and uniforms and that. As you know, the Seaforths are a Mackenzie regiment, and Frank Ross himself, his mother's folk, I gather, were Mackenzies because his name is Frank Mackenzie Ross. And the Seaforth had a very fine reputation in this community and had done this distinguished service. And then, as I say, both Bonner and John McClain, the members of the Seaforth. Mm-hmm. But there was some opposition to this on the grounds of the members of the COTC in the main, that they didn't want to be confused with the Seaforths. And we finally settled for what is quite common in Highland regiments, the Royal Stuart tartan and plaid for the pipers. And now, as the years passed, and as the numbers enrolled in the COTC grew smaller, and as the actual interest in the military affairs diminished somewhat, the pipe band seemed to disappear gradually. There would be fewer pipers remaining, fewer students who played the pipes or the drums. So that by the time I left the university, there was no longer a pipe band and no one to teach them the piping and so on and so forth.
In referring to these faculty members who became commanding officers, how would you explain their interest in COTC?
Well, the Schramm had served himself in World War I with the artillery, I think it was, in the ranks, and won a military medal. And he had a natural interest in the COTC for that reason. Bob Bonner came from active service practically right into the, and John McClain, just with a few years between him and active service. Ranta, not sure what units he served with. But
Dr. Ranta did not serve.
I don't think he was.
But he was with COTC since 1944.
Yes. I think he was in medicine and attached to, he was with us on the campus as more or less the medical aide for the university.
Finley Morrison was aide to General Creer in the Second
Correct.
World War.
That's right. And he naturally had a keen interest in military affairs and the officer training corps.
Also, Ray Herbert. Now he was.
Oh well, Ray, who lived just across the lane here from where we are now. Ray had a very good record with the Canadian Air Force, and turned out to be a natural with them. Very popular, and I believe he and his unit, when they went off for summer training, were among the best in Canada.
The UBC UNTD also distinguished itself by winning a proficiency award.
Oh, definitely. As I say, the officer commanding that in the first instance was Professor McElwraith in engineering, and he turned that over to Morris Young.
First, Frank Turner.
Frank Turner, true. Frank left the university and went into insurance business, I think it was. And then Morris Young, who again was in the medical profession, and made an excellent commanding officer of the UNTD, turned up. And his unit, was one of the best in the country.
You mentioned military backgrounds as being one reason why it would be natural for these people to be interested in the military training for the students. Do you think there are other factors?
I think that in terms of their own philosophy of society, that they felt that both in terms of being available if they were ever needed in the future, or in terms of their contribution to the nation itself in civilian capacities, and the COTCs were, and the other units, were valuable and important. And in addition, it gave to the members an experience and an opportunity to earn a bit of money during the summer months. Some of them, I think, were sent off to various parts of Canada for training.
Yeah.
Some of them, I think, even got to Germany, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Attached to the
some of the students
units over
students.
There. All of this was not only interesting and attractive, but in my opinion, very valuable to our society, the one we live in.
These people would have been had distinguished positions in public service and other things, and here they're involved in the training of people who are going to be officers.
Yes.
In the armed forces, and there is a parallel, I think, with their own position in society of public service and wanting to train people who would be
follow their example.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And contribute in a voluntary capacity.
Yes.
Or in other ways to the public services of the social services, and by that I don't mean the professional social services, but the local services of the community.
Yes.
Both by example and through experience.
Would you remember in February 1946 a meeting with General Creer, who was touring Canada and touring the various units?
I knew General Creer when he was Colonel Creer with the Department of National Defense, as I knew General Stewart, who was Major and then Colonel Stewart, who was the editor of the Defense Quarterly. I think I wrote one or two articles for him when I was with the University of Toronto. But I do remember the visit that Creer made to the campus, and we were very happy to have him and enjoyed his visit.
In the report on that visit, it said that the future training was discussed, the future direction of training on campus. I guess it would be very difficult to remember the details.
Well, this was a matter more for the officer commanding the other officers in the COTC than it was for the president, who was concerned with the maintenance of the COTC and its effective operations, but the details of the training services was something else again. That was a matter for the military based on their own experience and their own reading and their own ideas about the future, the requirements of men and weapons and so on and so forth.
Quotas were starting to be reduced in 1954. This is when the restrictions were cut down. COTC was limited to 35 at that time. And you mentioned earlier this is the economies were foremost in mind.
The beginning of what I claim was a very mistaken policy, but there it was.
This has steadily diminished to 20 in 1960, 15 finally in 19, well, until the end. at this time, too, there was, I think, a decline in interest.
Oh, yes.
Amongst the students.
As the war faded from the memories of the people of Canada, particularly the young people who had no personal knowledge or experience of it, it was inevitable that the interest in military training generally and in the COTCs would diminish. And then there was the apparently normal, usual reaction against the idea of war and against military activity and military expenditures. And this was perhaps more pronounced in the student body than anywhere else in our society. And then, of course, the state of the war in Vietnam and the propaganda, both sides, in respect of that war, flowed over into Canada and influenced the thought and action of Canadians and particularly Canadian students. So that as after World War I, though not to the same extent or not with the same speed, interest in and participation in military training of all kinds diminished. And got to a lower and lower ebb, so that even if the government had continued to maintain its support, I'm certain that the officer training units would have continued, but with much smaller numbers. I would think that in total, probably not more than 200 or 300 in all three services would enroll in, including young women, because the young women did, after the war, enroll in the officer training units and appeared on the parades on the issuing of certificates and the passing of parades, as they were called, which were held in the armories, and which, when the units were substantial in size, were very impressive occasions. Again, the lieutenant governor, his aides, the heads of all of the military units in the area, including the permanent force, were on hand to lend color and importance to the occasion.
This is a slight digression. Do you think that the military esprit on the BC coast was as strong as in Nova Scotia?
different. In Nova Scotia, for instance, in the mid-1800s, the militia was more or less of a family affair, and every able-bodied man was liable to call up if necessary in defense of it. And I know in the case of my own family regiment, the 78th Pictou Highlanders, Seaforths, which was raised and maintained in that particular county. One of my uncles, John T. Sutherland, the major in charge of one of the companies, and he had the equipment of his company stored in his own farmhouse. I remember as a boy borrowing one of the Glengarry caps that the Seaforths wore. My younger brother borrowed another one. We went off fishing in a little brook, and my brother stepped into a wasp's nest and got stung in the rear there, and departed rather rapidly and left his Glengarry there. And I'm sure the Glengarry, we didn't go back after, I'm sure the Glengarry is there, and sometime in the future they'll find the badge of the 78th Pictou Highlanders and wonder what Indian had or other one had intervened there. But this was in a way more typical. Out here, there were some of the ranger units, the Rocky Mountain Rangers and so on, for the interior, but the concentration was in Vancouver and Victoria, I believe. The Seaforth and the other numerous units, the Irish and British Columbia and so on, excellent regiments that gave excellent service in both wars. And in Victoria, the Canadian Scottish, which was originally, they helped to form the 16th Battalion overseas, and they wore the Seaforth tartan. But they were made up originally, I think, of four different Highland units. And after the war, because the Seaforths here, Vancouver, wore the Seaforth Mackenzie tartan, they decided to adopt a different one, which is right and proper. They carry on their own traditions over there.
It's less of a family affair than on the beach.
I would say it's less of a family affair than it was originally in Nova Scotia.
Yes.
It was a sort of...
more wide open.
Every householder was more or less prepared to defend his home and his county and his province, if necessary, both individually and then collectively, in a way that was natural for that period. But of course it changed. There were a few Canadians who went over to try and save General Gordon, who was besieged and was killed in the Sudan. They were employed on the Nile in the riverboats there, but they were taken from the logging camps and guides and so on who could handle boats and canoes. So that the Boer War was, I think, the first time that Canadians, though one of the first Victoria Crosses won by a Canadian was won by a Negro from Nova Scotia who had been on one of the British warships, I think, and was present at the relief of City of Lucknow, and there he fearless in terms of leaping into the breach and dealing with guns that were being fired at, that he was awarded a military cross. He's buried somewhere in a little grave in the country community in Nova Scotia. But individuals, as I say, they participated in the American Civil War, mainly on the North, but always as volunteers. And, Halifax, of course, was a very important naval and military base throughout the 19th century and the 18th century.
Going back now, did you think there's any difference between the Liberals and the Conservatives in power in Ottawa and their approach towards the units? Campus units?
I would be inclined to feel that it depended a bit on the prime ministers of the day. And I don't think Mackenzie King was ever keen about the Department of National Defense or the militia or the officer training. This was contrary, I think, to his nature. He was more interested in what you might call the social issues, social services, employment and unemployment, and all of this was part of his training and background and temperament.
But the Conservatives were in power now from 57 to 63 period.
Yes. And I don't think there was any particular difference there. The Liberals, as I say, with Brooke Claxton and Doug Abbott, and Mike Pearson, all of whom had war experience, and all of whom I know were interested in the officer training units at the various campuses. And Mackenzie King would be inclined to leave matters of that kind to them. Not concern himself with them. General Perks, of course, in the conservative ranks, he and General Worthington, who had been officers commanding the Pacific Command out here, they had both been most helpful to the university during and after the war in a variety of ways, and were interested in the officer training course on the campus. So that I think it was more a matter of personality than of philosophy as between various parties.
I see.
The CCF tended to be anti-war, pacifist inclined. Agnes MacPhail and Woodsworth, for instance, were I think honestly and genuinely pacifist inclined, and would feel that the officer training corps was creating an attitude in young men, young women, that it wasn't what they were really interested in or believed in. So I would be inclined to feel it would get less support from people of that kind in that party.
What did you think of integration when they started that?
I, following my own experience in World War I later, felt that it was quite unnecessary to have three departments, paymasters and postmasters and hospital services and that. These I felt could very usefully be either merged or a degree of cooperation between them to prevent the duplication and overlapping of services. But the actual merging of the three forces, I don't think I was prepared to go that far. I think there was so much in the tradition and in the uniform and in the esprit de corps of particularly the Navy and the Air Force and of the military units individually in the Army that was lost with the merging of them all together.
Did you express your opinion at the time that this was going on to any authorities?
I don't think I did publicly. I was in Ottawa as a senator.
Yes.
At that time. And I knew Hellyer, and I knew I used to sit in on the Liberal caucus, though I ranked in the Senate as an independent Liberal. Vote as a spirit movement, you're the issue that appealed to me. I knew all of these. Now I felt that the idea, the principle of the integration of the services was a good one, provided it was carried out with some discretion and some regard for points I've mentioned.
Could you tell me about what you did when in the period when you were senator and the move came about to disband the campus units?
Well, I wrote some letters.
Who to?
Expressed myself firmly in respect of them. No, I don't think I made speeches about them. I've often found over the years that if you direct your views to the key people as individuals, you get farther than waging a public campaign which may arouse their opposition and resentment.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Perhaps this was...
Did you talk to Mr. Hellyer then personally about the issue?
I think that I wrote to them about the disbandment of the COTC and of the liquidation of the militia units during the whole of that period, whoever was in the war. I know one evening I was at the annual dinner of the Sea Force, and Mr. Campney, who was then, I think, Minister of National Defense, or he was anyway a minister in the government, was there. And he called on me for a few words, and I chided him about the liquidation of every unit military unit I had ever belonged to. which I didn't think was necessary. Of course, the extreme example of this was the liquidation of the Black Watch. It's a permanent unit, a Montreal-based unit. I think I know the reasons why this was done, but I think it was stupid and unnecessary and unwise.
Did you think at any stage that there was a chance of stopping that disbandment? Because I'm sure other lots of units mounted a campaign against being liquidated.
With the kind of social temperament of the day and the rising costs of defense, so-called, anyway, and the natural desire of the permanent force to retain as much as they possibly could of the limited budget. It was very difficult to do anything effective about it. I think, as I say, the public weren't particularly interested in or concerned about the expenditure of money on any of these operations because of the difference in the temper of the times.
Did you stand up in the Senate and give a talk about this
issue?
No. You didn't?
No, it wasn't on our agenda.
Oh.